case involves three issues. First, did Barnhart get a fair trial in light of the trial court judge's repeated questioning of witnesses? Clearly, it's not inappropriate for a trial court judge to ask questions of witnesses, but at some point it crosses the line and deprives the defendant of his right to a fair trial. And it crossed the line in this case, not only because of the quantity of questions that Judge McCuskey asked of the witnesses, but the distinct difference between the questions he asked of the government's witnesses and the questions he asked of the defense witnesses.
Can I stop you there for just a second? It was not clear to me from your briefs what standard of review you think applies to this question. I know that the government says it's plain error because there was no objection. I'm not sure where you come out on that, though.
Well, it's interesting to point out whether there was an objection or not, because as the court knows, it's a very difficult situation in trial strategy for a defendant who's called upon to object to the judge for asking a question. And so I think that to hold the defendant to the standard that he didn't object is unrealistic as to the dynamic that would take place in a courtroom if a judge were seen objecting to the judge's, if a defense lawyer were seen objecting to the judge's own line of questioning.
I certainly can appreciate that. Let me ask you, though, what about a sidebar? What about asking for a sidebar? I mean, the thing I see here is a potential that if you raised that question after the first question, the second question, he might have given the judge a little pause. But if whether that could, I don't know whether some judges like sidebars, some don't. I don't have any feel for the circumstances of this case. Can you help us with that?
And I think that the other aspect of that then is it's not any single question. And these questions may have been legally appropriate had they been asked by opposing counsel. But it's the cumulative effect and the fact that the questions, cross-examination style, are coming from the judge. So even a sidebar, at that sidebar, maybe after the third or fourth question would be, I object to that question, Your Honor. Well, your objection's overruled because it's a legitimate question. But you have to take a step back and then realize at the conclusion, gee, you kind of set the tone here with a series of questions and cross-examination style questions. So I think it's a difficult, it's difficult for us to sit here now and say, well, you should have objected, because the objection would have been possibly bad strategy, possibly counterproductive, and also at what point in the cumulative effect would one make that objection? The second issue that I'd like to draw the court's attention...
What would you say is the worst example of the judges asking a slanted question?
He asks a defense witness, isn't the real reason... Now, that kind of syntax, isn't the real reason... might be something that you'd expect out of a cross-examining.
What witness was that he was talking to?
Your Honor, I'd have to...
It's Mr. Davis, right?
Yeah, Jeff Davis, the defendant's civil attorney. He asks him, isn't the real reason? Well, that tone of voice coming from the judge may telegraph to the jury that the judge has formed an opinion about the outcome of this case. And you don't see that language when the judge interposes questions to the government witnesses. That's, in fact, at one point he suggests to the prosecutor that he should have a document he's using labeled as an exhibit and introduced into evidence. The second issue I want to call the court's attention to is the degree to which the assistant United States attorney was allowed to use prior dishonest conduct to impeach the defendant when the defendant testified. It amounts to the prohibited parading of this prior impeachable.
But that's permitted by Rule 608, right?
You're permitted, certainly.
It's not like 609 in that respect.
Correct. It is permitted, and our objection once again goes to the quantity, the 5 pages of transcript are taken up, and I'd refer to the court to the language in Campbell versus Greer where it says you can't parade it lovingly before the jury. And at some point, when you go on for 5 pages trying to tell the jury that the defendant has a prior felony conviction or has previously acted in a dishonest manner, 5 pages of transcript crosses into that line where it's parading it lovingly, as the terms were used in the Campbell versus Greer case.
Was it paraded at the closing as well?
I don't recall. I do not recall. I didn't do the trial work in this case, so I just don't recall that. And the third and final point I want to make is with respect to the offense level, which had a 16-level upward adjustment for a loss of excess of $1 million, and we think it should have been a 14-level upward adjustment because the loss was greater than $400,000 but less than $1 million. And the reason we disagree about the amount of the loss is that the Barnhart's paramour and business partner, Dr. Sandra Schwartz, had loaned him $600,000 for this auto body business, and the judge included that $600,000 as part of the monetary loss, and we think the evidence really was that it was more in the way of an investment she was making in the defendant's startup auto body business with the hope of some return, and maybe a bad investment, but it was an investment and it wasn't part of the charge. And so we think that the real the offense level should have been calculated as being the $500,000 that was lost to the DuPont Corporation because they guaranteed the loan that the defendant got to open up this startup auto body business.
Well, there was all kinds of evidence, wasn't there, that he lied to her about the corporate premises?
Well, there may have been, but it's not a crime to lie to your lover, you know. And I think that it wasn't criminal. He wasn't. She had made an investment. She thought she was a shareholder. She was a shareholder.
That's what he told her, that she was going to have an 85% ownership interest, which was not.
He wasn't charged with having committed a crime wherein she was a victim.
I understand that, but this is, you know, relevant fraudulent conduct committed against his girlfriend to get her to part with $600,000.
Well, her parting with the $600,000 all predates the loan from DuPont and the criminal activity with which he was charged in this case. So we think it should have been separated out, her $600,000. That's our position on that one. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Aik?
May it please the Court, my name is Amanda Aikman, appearing on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start out with the judge's questions. First of all, as to the standard of review, we do believe that it's a plain error standard. This Court has never held that the failure to make objections to judge's questions means that it's subject to some other standard of review.
Does Judge McCuskey still have his policy about not permitting sidebars?
I'm not aware of that, of whether he does or not, but there would have been an opportunity to, during a recess, for example, raise that issue. The inquiry before this Court, then, is whether the judge's questions conveyed a bias, and if so, whether the defendant suffered a...
Understand, why did he ask these questions? I think it's extremely improper in a criminal jury trial, peppering the witnesses with questions. What?
Well, with regard to the...
What's the lawyer supposed to do?
Well, with regard to the questions to...
Judge, that's an improper question.
I think
you should instruct the jury to disregard your question.
First of all, the judge did say at the beginning of trial during preliminary instructions and at the end that anything he said was not to be considered.
That's ridiculous.
Limiting instruction.
The jury is going to take its cues from the judge.
Well, with respect to his questions, I won't stand here and say that every single one of them was necessary, but I do think that the inquiry is whether they conveyed a bias.
It doesn't matter whether many of them were innocuous. Some of them were very hostile to Barnhart.
I'd like to discuss the one of the ones which defense counsel raises, the real reason language, because in context, I think it's clear that the judge was not casting aspersions on the witness's honesty. This interchange took place when the defense counsel was asking Mr. Davis about the meaning of the term senior indebtedness in the loan agreement with DuPont. And defense counsel asked whether it meant that the $500,000 DuPont loan would be superior to everyone. Those were his words. In his response, Mr. Davis gave a confusing answer referencing purchase money indebtedness and the need to perfect one's claim through attachment. And it was at that point that the judge interjected, well, and the real reason for this is that DuPont wants to make sure in a startup business they're going to get the first $500,000. Would that sort of be a short answer? So basically, he's just paraphrasing what, you know, repeating the question
that
the defense counsel just asked.
Davis's answer was vague and confusing, but that's helpful to the defendant. It's the defendant's witness, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so for the judge to cross-examine the defendant's witness, in effect, and say, "Don't you mean this?" and he says, "Yes, I mean that." Well, that turns him into a government witness.
I think the judge was just trying to clarify the issue for the jury in this particular instance.
That was harmful to the defendant.
Well, even if this court were to find that some of the questions by the judge in this case...
Not only were some of the questions bad, but there were too many questions. It was a short trial. There's no basis for that. And, you know, this is a pattern with Judge McCuskey. We've commented in other cases about this.
Yes, in the McRae and Washington cases, that's correct.
Shouldn't be doing this stuff.
In both of those cases, however, in one of them, this court didn't reach the bias question and found that there was no serious prejudice regardless, and in the other one, there was no bias.
Yes, I know, but that doesn't mean the fact that there weren't reversals in those cases doesn't mean that this is a good practice for the judge to be following.
Yes.
Bad practice.
But in the context of this case, given the strength of the government's evidence and the fact that the limiting instruction was given, even if this court were to find bias, we believe that the defendant cannot demonstrate that he suffered serious
prejudice. I don't understand what the limiting instruction could, what significance that could have.
Well, this court has held in...
What about fictions?
This court has held in Evans and McRae cases that such instructions can reduce the risk of error.
Seriously. That's fiction, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think jurors are presumed to follow...
What's your basis for thinking that? In fact, the way you put it, you say they're presumed. In other words, you don't know anything about how they actually think.
Yes.
It's just some presumption that's been stated in appellate opinions.
Yes,
there's no basis in reality, as far as you know.
There may very well be a basis in reality.
There may be a basis in reality. That's true of anything.
Well, Your Honor, if you have no further questions on the issue as to the judge's questions, I can move on to the cross-examination. We believe that the cross-examination as to the 60B acts was warranted because the defendant chose to testify and put his credibility at issue. The acts about which he was questioned bore directly on his character for truthfulness or untruthfulness. The defendant had convinced a friend named Anthony Matoyan to invest $40,000 in a luxury suite at Daytona Speedway and instead had taken the money for his personal use. So it was in the court's discretion to determine that the knowledge of these prior deceptive acts would assist the jury in assessing the defendant's testimony. And also, before the defendant took the stand, the court twice confirmed that if he chose to testify, the court would allow the government to raise the prior deceptive acts as they bore on his credibility. Again,
it dooms his case, right?
I'm sorry?
There's no point in testifying if you're going to have that stuff thrown at you.
That was his decision to take the stand.
He was also fairly evasive during this line of questioning, which perhaps accounts for why it took five pages to get him to admit that prior conduct was deceptive.
Yes, I think that may have been part of the problem. As to the... loss calculation issue. Give me one moment. We believe that the district court properly found that defendant's fraud against Ms. Schwartz was relevant conduct resulting in a loss which could be included at sentencing. The fraud was clearly part of the same course of conduct as the scheme to defraud DuPont. They took place actually at the same time frame, and both schemes involved the defendant obtaining funds allegedly for Blue Star and then diverting them for personal use. In addition, the government showed that Ms. Schwartz's loss was the result of criminal conduct by the defendant. The defendant persuaded her to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in exchange for an ownership interest, which never materialized. She never became a shareholder of the corporation. And the amount of the loss itself was supported by extensive evidence, including Blue Star accounting records, bank records, a schedule prepared by Ms. Schwartz and testified to at trial. And finally, the inclusion of the expenses on the corporate credit cards was proper, was documented. The evidence showed that Blue Star received the bills for the corporate credit cards, paid them, and that Ms. Schwartz had no role in the day-to-day business, the day-to-day operations of Blue Star. And finally, the defendant admitted when at trial that he had used some of the money on the some of the cards to pay for a trip to the Cayman Islands with a different paramour, I suppose, and to buy a Rolex watch. And so it was within, you know, the judge was entitled from this evidence to find that the inclusion of the corporate credit cards was proper. This court has no further questions. We will rest on our briefs and ask that you affirm the convictions and the sentence below.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Aikman. Mr. Bruno, you have anything further? Save any time? 2 minutes? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Of course, a limiting instruction is of very little practical use. A trial court judge could say, never mind the fact that I've telegraphed to you that I think he's guilty. Don't consider that. You make your mind up in a vacuum. But a seasoned or even a not-so-seasoned courtroom observer of these proceedings, if asked at the end of the evidence, would you like to have the jury waived at this point and let Judge McCuskey decide this case, would have had a good read on how Judge McCuskey felt about it just from listening to the tone of his questions. And you shouldn't have a read. The judge should be able to maintain that umpire-like neutral appearance in front of the jury. It may be difficult to do. But once you telegraph that you've developed an opinion too, you become this 13th juror, this super juror, who has sent a message to these lay people in the jury box that it's appropriate to have formed an opinion as to how this case should come out. With respect to whether or not this was some overwhelming case upon which these errors can all be categorized as harmless, I need only draw the court's attention to the fact that count one was a hung jury. There were people back there in that jury room arguing that the government had not made its burden of proof on count one. They couldn't reach a unanimous verdict on count one.
That was a completely unrelated incident.
It may have been, but these jurors had found some distinction. There were some people in that jury room who thought the government had brought a charge and not proved it against. I think that is some small window of insight into, is this some overwhelming case to where the jury was ready to vote on this as soon as they walked back into the deliberation room? Well, maybe on counts two and three, we don't know that. We never know that. But we do know one thing. They couldn't reach a unanimous verdict on count one. There were some people back there that thought the government hadn't made its case. I think that's a little window into whether or not this is the overwhelming case. It's always easy to take a jury verdict and argue that a case was overwhelming because they came back guilty, but we never know.